One of the things we as historians are rather bad at doing is thinking about the visceral sides of memory, the emotional sides, the sentiments and feelings and moods which the war and its events gave rise to, which people don't really verbalise, sometimes because they don't know how, but which we all know are there. Those senses of loss, those senses of nostalgia, those senses of not being able to make sense of the violence and the bereavement and the pain, but also the sort of wider problems people had of placing their experiences, often very violent ones, in a wider story. So I wanted to kind of find a way of pursuing this, these sort of emotional dynamics of post-war history. And I felt that this was an opportune moment then to engage with a big new field, firstly, which is the history of the emotions, which has grown up as an interesting area, not just for historians of Germany, but for historians more generally. So it's a chance to kind of try and move into something new, but pursue some old questions for me at the same time.
And music, of course, does evoke emotion.
Well, that's the kind of the great question, really. Does music evoke emotion? Does it narrate emotion? Does it express emotion that's already there? And if it does, how can we, you know through music that that emotion is there? So these things have also opened up recently as big questions amongst both historians and musicologists. And I thought it would be fun then to try to put the two questions together, that the history of listening to music, how people listen to music, how they make sense of it, what it expresses for them and what they inadvertently express when they talk about music on the one hand, and those questions of the memory of the war. So what I'm trying to do really is mix the history of memory with the history of the senses and the history of the emotions, and find a way of talking about Richard Strauss, which places him at the middle or the interstices of those three fields.
You're interested in looking at, in examining him, what he did, why he may have done it?
Well, I'm starting with a particular work that Strauss wrote at the end of the war, Metamorphosen, which is a short 20-odd minute work for 23 solo strings, which was written at a point in time when the Third Reich was collapsing, Auschwitz had just been liberated, the cultural traditions of which Strauss saw himself as being the last heir were seemingly coming to an end with it. And so he wrote this kind of incredibly sort of doleful, baleful piece, which seemed to many listeners to express all the kind of sadness and woe of the end of the war and the collapse of the Third Reich. So one starting point has to be thinking about Strauss and his own motives for writing the piece. But I'm really interested less in Strauss and the work than in the ways in which people responded to it. So the question I'm trying to open up is less a sort of work-centred one, which we would tend to leave to the musicologists, really, but really more the question of the work that the work does as it moves through post-war culture. How do people hear it? How do they listen to it? How do they respond to it? What images does it evoke, and what thoughts does it prompt? And when they talk about that, what kind of emotional languages can we see being articulated, and what might that in turn enable us as historians to access?
A big project. You started at the time with contemporary reactions. What did people think then?
Well, it's easier to answer the question starting really with what people tend to think now, and then to work backwards to what was slightly more specific and different then. Now it takes its place within a late 20th, early 21st century culture of memory, which tends to focus overwhelmingly on the experience of the bombing itself and the associated violence and destruction. Strauss started writing the piece out the day after the Vienna State Opera House was destroyed in the bombing in early 1945. And his letters of the time are full of comments about the destruction of Germany's concert houses and opera houses, the sites in which he'd conducted and had his works premiered going back to the turn of the century. And so there's been a sense in which this piece has been taken as being about the bombing, about the destruction, about the memory of the event, and that it's been an expression of a certain self-centered, narcissistic focus on German suffering at the end of the war, which in quite obvious ways, is rather blinkered, I suppose, given that it's written just at the point when Auschwitz was liberated. If we look, say, at how this piece was talked about by contrast in the 50s and the 60s, we see a lot of that discussion too, a lot of the reflection on the destruction and the violence and the events of the end of the war. But what's interesting is that you also see something different being described in reviews or LP liner notes or CD notes slightly later, or concert programmes, and that's a memory not just of the destruction itself, but also of the life that was there before the destruction took place. So a more wistful nostalgia for the turn of the century culture of Wilhelmine Germany and its concert life, its performance life, the streets and the squares and the places of old Dresden or Munich or Vienna or Berlin, if you like. So a memory of place, a memory of a life destroyed, as much as a memory of the destruction itself. So what people in the immediate post-war period were hearing was actually not just mourning, it was also nostalgia, if we can pin it down to that distinction. And that corresponds to a very different way of listening to the piece itself, in which contemporaries heard something more joyous, if you like, and more kind of happily and fondly reminiscent of carefree times before the Nazi era. And it's that distinction I'm trying to tease out, because I think it gives us access to a very distinctive emotional landscape in the 1950s, 60s and into the 70s, which we've tended to lose sight of as we focus more on the destruction caused by the bombing itself.